Books of the Bible. The book of Job answers the question, why do the righteous suffer? When Job loses everything, his friends blame him. But when Job questions the Lord, he responds, God is sovereign and he is good. His ways are beyond our understanding. When you suffer, know that God is in control. He has his own purposes that you may not understand. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
All right, Jimmy, fine. This is Wretched Radio. Jimmy, this is like walking in a field of landmines where you can just blow up with any simple misstep. We're talking about Dr. John MacArthur's take on Christian nationalism. As always, crystal clear, the Bible doesn't support it. You have to work very, very hard to come up with the idea that Jesus is interested in somehow Christians imposing their theology, morals, and values through a government system in order to achieve a more moral society. I believe the Bible is clear. He's after saving sinners in every nation.
There you go.
Which was your concern, because I was saying that Jesus isn't interested in nation building.
Right.
But you said at the end of Matthew, Jesus says what?
Go and make disciples of all nations.
But, yep, exactly. And right. Your concern was that somebody might think that Jesus doesn't have any interest in nations.
Right. And that's...
And I stick with that. Jesus has interest in people.
Right.
Which, and in the nations. And he's going to take his gospel outside of Israel because he does desire to save all people groups. But that use of nations is different than the context of what we're discussing with Christian nationalism.
Exactly.
That he's interested in nation building. That somehow his church is involved in the government for the sake of a more orderly society. Now, please note, I'm all for Christians being involved in politics. We rejoice when the righteous rule. Make no mistake about it. I would much rather have a born-again Christian in office than a nominal Christian and as somebody who's anti-Christian, for sure. Absolutely. But that's different than using collective muscle in an effort to mandate that the government behave based on our holy book. We bring the truths of our holy book wherever we go is salt and light. So if you're a Christian politician, you like to volunteer, you get involved in these things, I say rock on. Bring your Christianity. Let it inform you how we go about the business of structuring society. But that's different than a Christian nationalism that says it is Christianity that must be the driving force of the nation. So there's a fair amount of, I think, mutual desire. It's just the means to get there. And I believe Jesus is constantly revealing. He could have kicked Herod off of the throne. As a baby, he could have deposed Herod. Instead, he had to be taken to Egypt to be spared from the king. When he could communicate, he could have spoken down a fire from heaven to destroy Herod's rule. Didn't do it. And then when he was even asked about taxation, he said, give it to the government, what you have to give to the government. Give to God what you want to give to God. My kingdom is not of this world. The only authority that you have, Pilate, is the power that has been given to you by my Father. And Jesus didn't exercise his power to dethrone or to overthrow a system that was terrible. You talk about it, the Roman system. Now, I think we can agree it was better than the Assyrian or the Babylonian system, but it was still a system of genuine oppression. And there was a dance that had, and believe me, Israel was kind of... If back then, if the Roman Empire could have had some sort of a map that lit up with the hot spots, Israel was typically on fire because the Jewish people didn't like that they were oppressed. They denied it. That was the conversation with Jesus in the marketplace, wasn't it? We've never been slaves. You are currently. And they denied it. They hated the Roman Empire being involved in their mess. Why wasn't Jesus a zealot? It's interesting. One of his disciples was a zealot, and you don't see him anymore bearing the sword to be a zealot. He became a fisher of men. That's what Jesus is after. And if we try, I understand how tricky this gets. I really, really do. Because it's not wrong to be involved in government. It's not wrong to want Christianity to influence policy. I get that. But imagine, let's just imagine. Now, this is going to be pretty ridiculous and, okay, leaves your flank open for assault. But nevertheless, what if I made the case that Christians need to be involved in, you know, I'm trying to think of a hobby that I have, but I don't actually have one. Wow. I just had an epiphany. My life is pathetic. All right, let's try to imagine a different thing that is good for society. Food production, food transportation. If I said we've got to, everybody's got to be involved in food transportation, and God's interest in making sure that food transportation systems run efficiently and well so that people can be fed, you'd go, well, yeah, I agree. Yeah, he does. But I don't see that mandated in the Bible. I don't see that being the driving force. And it is interesting. I have collected now, and I don't go to these sites all the time, but these are good websites where there are thoughtful people writing. These, I suspect, are brothers that I would not have an issue spending eternity with. But I've collected a number of articles that try to make the case for Christian nationalism. And I've noticed this is a glaring omission from all of these arguments for a Christian nationalism of the Stephen Wolfe type of variety, a lack of Bible verses. So for instance, I have one, it's 14 pages long, and this is to talk about why Christian nationalism is so important. I went through the entire article and I found two Bible verses quoted. Now, there were other verses cited, but there were only two that were quoted. 14 pages. So for instance, this line is, Genesis 1-2 says nothing about sexual relations. It's kind of a drive-by. But then as I read through the article, I notice there's no Bible verses. Oh, there's Thomas Aquinas. He's being quoted. Oh, there's Herman Bavinck. There's Augustine. There's Samuel Willard. He's quoted. We got Martin Luther. He's quoted. Johannes Althusius. He's quoted. Richard Baxter, the Puritan. He's quoted. Ah, there we get to Revelation 7:9. Of a great multitude which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, and stood before the throne, before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands. And that's the verse that is mainly used to support it. That's a theme. It's an argument that has to be built from inference. But it isn't built from direct biblical commands. It just isn't. You can't get there. So for instance, here's another one. This one is 5 pages long. That is a promotion of a Christian nation. Zero Bible verses. Here's one that talks about Protestant nationalism. 6 pages long, zero Bible verses. Here's one talking about John Calvin's political theory. 5 pages long, zero Bible verses. Now, he does quote Ulrich Zwingli. Martin Luther mentions the Ten Commandments. Greek and Roman philosophers, John Locke, they're mentioned, but no Bible verses. This is an article that's 10 pages long, and it is all about trying to explain what Christian nationalism is. John Winthrop of Boston, John Calvin, he's quoted, Theodore Betza, Martin Bucer is quoted, these are all referred, Samuel Rutherford, Thomas Aquinas, Article 23 from the Westminster Confession of Faith, the Treaty of Paris of 1783, but no Bible verses. There's a reason for that. I get it. I get the power of the argument. And I don't, where these conversations and these understandings always tend to lead toward acrimony, is that there's some overlap. That's like, yeah, I agree with, yes, I do agree with that. And yes, it is better if biblical principles, nobody's denying that. But we have to ask ourselves the question, what is the Lord after? Even read the book of Revelation. He's not going to be holding up America to go, look at, or he's not going to hold up Great Britain. Look at this nation that I really ruled in or had an impact on. No, what is it? A great sea of people from all nations, of every tribe, of every tongue. Why? Why do we see that and not somehow, I mean, I'm not trying to be cheeky, but like a Super Bowl ring of nations. It's people, souls. Why? Because that's the greater thing. That's the greater, taking a wicked rebel and turning him into an individual that loves the Lord Jesus Christ. That's the greater work, and that is what he is after. This is Wretched Radio.
What do you get when you combine eight of today's most trusted Christian voices with a commitment to unwavering biblical truth? Well, of course, you get Fortis Institute, your daily source for spiritual strength. We're not offering opinions here. We're providing a fortress of biblical wisdom for these challenging times that we're all living in. Every day, our fellows deliver fresh content that tackles real issues. Dr. John Crott shows you how to integrate theology into daily life. Brad Bigney transforms your struggling marriages into thriving relationships. Greg Gifford helps to bring biblical solutions to anxiety and depression. Plus, get exclusive access to private events, webinars, and studio sessions as a Fortis Insider. The best part? It's all free. Just visit FortisInstitute.org right now and join our community of believers who refuse to be tossed to and fro by the cultural waves. From podcasts and videos to live events and daily hot takes, Fortis Institute provides the biblical foundation you need to stand strong. Because in times like these, we need more than just information. We need transformation. Question, what if everything you knew about God is absolutely true, but it's not changing how you live your life? I think we've all stood in that gap sometimes. Our theology, rock solid. Our hearts, they're still learning how to play catch up. And Dr. John Crotts, the host of Integrated, understands this struggle because he's lived it. He's the pastor of Faith Bible Church in Sharpsburg, Georgia, and of course, the host of the Integrated podcast at Fortis Plus, and he's discovered five powerful ways to bridge that gap between knowing God and truly loving him with everything we've got. In his new Fortis Forum, Head to Heart, which is available now on Fortis Plus, Dr. Crott shares how biblical characters like Stephen and Daniel didn't just memorize truth, they lived it under pressure. Here's what Dr. Crott has learned and what he's going to show you in his Fortis Forum. God uses everything, even our suffering, to move his truth from our heads to our hearts. If you're ready to turn doctrine into devotion, your heart's waiting, and so is this Fortis Forum hosted by Dr. John Crott. It's called Head to Heart, and it's available now on Fortis Plus. Hey, thanks for listening to Wretched Radio today. Picture this. Every morning, countless Christians are waking up and wondering how they're going to navigate today's increasingly complex and upside-down world. And that's where Fortis Institute comes in. Not just another ministry, but your daily partner in standing firm in biblical truth. I mean, you've probably noticed that we're different from our daily podcasts like Integrated with Dr. John Crotts or Thrive with Pastor Brad Bigney. We're bringing together some of the most trusted voices in Christianity to help you and your local church thrive. But here's the thing. This mission, well, it takes resources, and that's where you come in. By becoming an ongoing monthly gospel partner, you're not just supporting a ministry, you're investing in the spiritual fortification of countless believers and local churches across the nation. So will you join us? Visit FortisInstitute.org right now to become an ongoing monthly gospel partner, and together we can help Christians stand strong in their faith no matter what challenges tomorrow brings. Wretched. Amazing grace. Amazing gospel.
Revelation. General revelation is God's act of making himself known through his creation. A part of general revelation is the sensus divinatus, a sense of the divine. God has given every person an undeniable awareness of his existence. There are no true atheists, only rebels in denial of what every person knows to be true. This is Wretched Radio with Todd Friel.
Yikes! Kind of hot for the 60s. This is Wretched Radio. Do you want a revolution? That was the question that was posed by the Heidel blog for the people who are seeking a more muscular Christianity. He writes this: too many conservative Christians have focused on the seen rather than the unseen, thinking appearances at the White House or Meet the Press is evidence that they are making a difference. And we have to admit, actually, they might be making a difference. Like, it can be helpful. That's why these conversations have a tendency to go off the rails. I love it when somebody Christian speaks up on one of these talk shows. It's like a breath of fresh air. It's like, oh, there's still a sane person who can go on TV. But that doesn't mean that the Christian agenda is to somehow try to achieve a kingdom that is ruled by the church. Heidelblog says, nothing in the Bible commands believers to reform or redeem society through government and politics alone, or even mainly. Neither is there any expectation that non-Christians will be converted to the Christian point of view, which can vary on some topics, through politics. Do you want a revolution? May I ask you a question? What does that revolution look like as it plays out? That is a question that I think we see being exposed, perhaps is the best word, in an article from 1996 from Chuck Colson. Chuck Colson from Breakpoint, you'll recall the fellow who used to be a lawyer for Richard Nixon, went to jail because of his shenanigans, got saved. And he came out and he was an intellectual force. And he writes about the concerns that he sees with what's happening in our government in 1996. So I do believe we need to remember our government, it hasn't been stellar for a long time. Chuck Colson was, here's what he writes, in America today, we have nearly reached the completion of a long process I can only describe as the systematic usurpation of ultimate political power by American judiciary's usurpation that compels evangelical Christians to ask sobering questions about the moral legitimacy of the current political order and our allegiance to it. Whoa. Whoa. Chuck Colson is going to dive into some hot water, and it is worth noting in this 9-page treatise, he does talk about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He does share that we see instances in the Bible, which is absolutely correct, where we obey God before we obey man. Now, if we can obey man while obeying God, we obey man because we're obeying God when we obey man. But if man demands something that God forbids or desires, then Chuck Colson said it, we graciously accept the state's imposed consequences. And then he goes on to say, not all Christian thinkers have applied these principles in exactly the same way. And what we see here is the pattern that I recognize when it comes to conversations about a more muscular Christianity or a theonomy or a dominionist approach to Christian political theory. Who does he quote? John Calvin. And there's Augustine. There's Thomas Aquinas. There's the Scottish reformer John Knox, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So he uses them to say, hey, we see instances where people say, enough, we can't do this. Dietrich Bonhoeffer being one of them, which is why I think Eric Metaxas is on the crusade that he's on for a more muscular Christianity. Chuck Colson, the real questions facing us are, at what point does a government become sufficiently corrupt that Christians must actively resist it? Well, I would say I reject that question. Because Jesus, I think, sets the mandate in the Sermon on the Mount that we turn the other cheek. When we're commanded to go a mile, we go two. Now, not if they ask us to sin or they ask us to not obey a commandment from God or they get involved in church issues, meaning how we do worship, how we treat one another, how we raise our kids even. That is outside of their jurisdictional authority. So I'm not a fan of the word resist. If we have to say, sorry, no can do, as he stated earlier, it's a gracious response, not one of resistance. We're not the vigilante people. Jesus corrected the lex talionis in Acts chapter or Matthew chapter 5. It's a correct Pharisaical citing of scripture that you should not try to exact more punishment from somebody than what they have committed against you. So it's the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. It was intended to be a restraining order on how we behave. Now, none of us can be all that dogmatic in our understanding of how Israel's jurisprudence worked out and who dealt with criminals, but I think Jesus helps us with it. It is not privatized, that there is not a, you punch me, I get to punch you back. You take out my eye, I'm going to take out your eye. Jesus goes, no, you take it. Doesn't mean we don't avail ourselves of the government. It doesn't mean that we can't plead. It doesn't mean that we can't petition. It doesn't even mean we can't flee when we're being persecuted. But he's saying, you're not the vigilante people. You're not the ones who are going to deal with criminals. We let those in authority deal with criminals. Back to Chuck Colson. At what point does a government become sufficiently corrupt that we must actively resist it? Has the United States, under its current judicial regime, reached such a point? Well, that's a big question. That was 1996. It seems to me, writes Colson, that only the church in some corporate capacity, not the individual Christian, has the authority to answer the question of our allegiance to the present regime. I would ask Chuck, if he were still with us, well, who is that church? Who are the ecclesiastical leaders that get to make that determination? And where do we see those biblical criteria in the Bible? Because I don't think you're going to find them. Some kind of convocation, this is Chuck Colson, of theologically orthodox bodies could presumably join to consider the duty of Christians under the present order. Who are those bodies? Chuck Colson, no doubt, would engage the Roman Catholic Church because he was an ECT kind of guy. Who are these people? Who are these authorities? Only the church collectively can decide at what point a government becomes sufficiently corrupt that a believer must resist it. If after prayerful deliberation, Christians corporately determine, I don't see that ever happening. We can't agree on much, let alone this. If we corporately determine our present government has violated its God-given mandate, what then? After the pattern of the confessing German church, the church would first have to separate herself and declare her independence, disavowing any moral legitimacy indirectly or unofficially provided for the state in the past. Through her teaching and preaching office, the church would need to expose the nature of the state's rebellion against God. Well, that I agree with. We do that with any institution. We do that with any person, because that's actually commanded of us, bringing the state under the transcendent judgment of God. Well, he can do that whether we preach to them or not. But what if all these actions fail to deter the state? Churches must then consider a higher level of resistance. Huh, what are we talking about here? And my question would be, how do we put the brakes on this thing without becoming genuine revolutionaries who bear arms against our government? When peaceable means, Chuck Colson, and limited civil disobedience fail, at least according to John Knox, Samuel Rutherford, again, quoting theologians who were baked in a church-state mingling, not the Bible, we can be justified from a Christian viewpoint for a revolution. While Knox called for the overthrow of a ruler in the interest of the Reformation, Rutherford advocated revolt in any instance when a king or ruler acted contrary to the written law. Oh boy, how do you spell anarchy? Apparently, said Colson, many Christians in colonial times agreed after dumping tea into the Boston Harbor. Yeah, that is very true. But I can't use my Christian viewpoint about government based on the Boston Tea Party. Chuck Colson, near the end of his article, says, our discussions about the duty of Christians to the current American political order must be conducted with care in a manner that is formal rather than intuitive, deliberative rather than spontaneous, regulative rather than pragmatic. The problem is that we don't have those Bible verses that even point in that direction. And I would ask the question, if we're talking about revolution here, what does that mean? And what if my church decides it looks like something different than your church? And we simply have to ask ourselves the question, based on the Sermon on the Mount and Jesus telling us to pray for those, so did 1 Timothy 4. The point is, Paul said to Timothy that you pray for those in authority. That's what we, and we love our enemies. So let's let the conversation roll on. But as we do, even from this Chuckleson article, we got to do it biblically. And we've got to ask ourselves the question, if we don't have a way to put the brakes on this, where, oh, where will it end? And until tomorrow, go serve your king.